You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
Welcome to Pickle Me This, the officially unofficial podcast for Rick and Morty on Cartoon Network's Adult Swim. I'm your host, Jim.
And I'm Aaron.
You can subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. Today, we're talking about Season 1, Episode 6, Rick Potion Number 9. Here's Aaron with the recap.
Morty asks Rick to make a love potion to force his crush, Jessica, to return his affections. Against his better judgment, Rick whips up a serum synthesized from vole oxytocin and pheromones. While the serum causes Jessica to fall fanatically in love with Morty, it also combines with the flu virus she is currently carrying and becomes airborne, eventually leading to the entire school, then town, and eventually the world to crave Morty's love. Rick attempts to counteract these effects by mixing ever more improbable combinations of animal DNA, which eventually morphs the world's human population into horrifying Cronenberg-type monstrosities. Admitting defeat, Rick abandons this world with Morty and steps into another dimension where that reality's Rick and Morty had just been killed in a lab experiment and the two replaced their dead cells relatively seamlessly. Morty struggles to accept his new existence. Back on the original version of Earth, Morty's original family is immune from the effects of the serum and are forced to fight for their lives against the formerly human creatures that now crave their flesh and blood, which is so similar to Morty's. An ironic note, the Cronenberg apocalypse and absence of Rick from their lives has allowed the Smiths to become their very best savage selves.
So Aaron, what did you think of this episode?
I really liked it. It had a lot of really real relational truths being dispensed here. I thought it had a pretty good moral dilemma with, like, you know, Rick destroying an entire world versus Morty's original desire to essentially write to essentially come up with, as Rick calls it, a roofie potion. Mm-hmm. Like, it's one of the few times where, you know, Morty's a little morally compromised in the adventure. And I like the kind of a glimpse of Jerry. Like, we've been shitting on Jerry a lot in our coverage so far.
with good reason.
But it's nice to see him kind of freed from these crippling insecurities and self-doubt, because I don't know whether he just realized this on an instinctual level or he was just in full self-destructive mode because, you know, he thought Beth was cheating on him with another man. He didn't give a fuck anymore. But, you know, if he pulled his usual shit, he'd be a dead man. And leading to the epic exchange between him and Beth, where he goes, "I wish that shotgun was my penis," when he shot one of the Cronenberg monsters. And she says, "If it were, you could call me Ernest Hemingway."
Yeah.
And then Jerry's like, "I don't get that, and I don't need to." It's a great episode, and one of the more... We've had a lot of, like, the last three, the simulation one, the Me6 one, and this kind of done a lot to really enlarge the world that you can imagine that this show could be.
Oh, yeah.
And
I mean, this goes to a whole another level. This goes so far off the rails, and that's the thing that I love about it. It's, this show is not afraid to live with the consequences of its actions in a way that you don't often see, especially in these sort of animated series. That's one of the things that makes this maybe my favorite episode of the season. I think it also comes down to fantastic animation.
Oh yeah.
The creature design in this is so good. The way that they morph and just capturing that in this animated form, there's something delightful about it.
Yeah, I think that it's not just the consequences and the stakes, you know, like the fact that the family that we've known for five episodes now, utterly abandoned to fend for themselves. And it's not like, this isn't like in a Star Trek sense where it's like, oh, they're going to fix the timeline and just, like, it's going to disappear. It's like, these people are locked in this hellish world. And Rick just doesn't give. And the mind-blowing thing is, keep in mind, 12 episodes from now, you're not going to remember or care because, like, the fact that this dimensional shift is such so slight that it's almost like, it starts fucking with you. Like, what is of value to Rick at all except for his own conscious experience?
Sure.
And, you know, also, like, to the extent that he gets away with it, does it matter? You know, like, if you could put yourself, it's kind of like some of these questions with the simulation. If you had a simulation so accurate you didn't know it was a simulation, you know, is ignorance bliss, or do you really want to taste a real steak, you know? It goes back to that Matrix question, and this is, like, that writ large. Like, this is just a few degrees off of normality, but it's essentially, you know, the exact same, and does anything matter? And this is, like, this episode is a real jumping-off point for explorations of that. And it's kind of like this is a really important episode because it's a touchstone where several characters are going to come back and reflect about these events.
I mean, you can see in Morty's eyes at the end of this episode, this leaves him changed, right? And the thing about it, from Rick's perspective, what you were talking about earlier, I think is Rick is such a colossally selfish character that it's not about, like, it's not about what these people might think about their new reality, about how Morty might feel about it, because he himself doesn't give a shit. He realizes, you know, the full universality of all of it, none of this matters. It's a very nihilistic view, and so he puts those feelings onto Morty and everyone around him, frankly. And he doesn't allow them to sort of process things in their own way. He wants them to process them the way he does.
And
it comes out in, you know, even in within this microcosm, this episode here, where Rick is essentially like gloating the entire time, like, oh, look, Morty, I just fixed everything. Your grandpa's a genius. You were fucking wrong. You know who's wrong? You are. And then it turns out he's wrong. Like, he's, and then he tells Morty, oh, this must be the best day of your life, Morty. Because he was right. He's transferring these feelings of like selfishness and the desire to be right at all times, at all costs to himself and anyone else.
Massive projection.
Onto Morty, right? Sure. Who definitely doesn't feel that way. That's not what is going through Morty's head. So, like, it's, it just shows off what a colossal asshole Rick is.
And it's this, it's this thing where, you know, and like you said, the look on Morty's face whenever they fire up the Mazzy Star at the end here, which that's the other thing is, like, if you hear like a down tempo pop song in the last 5 minutes of a Rick and Morty episode, buckle the fuck up, because you're going to end up like Morty here. And just like, to look around and like to know that like, this is my family, but it's not my family. And how can you ever know any kind of real emotional truth again after you experience that? And also, like, how many times has Rick done this? How many times can you do this? Because those are kind of rules are kind of sort of established, but not really, because,
and they're all sort of meta rules, you know? It's like, well, we're making a show here and the audience is only going to give us so much leeway.
Right.
We can do this three, maybe four more times if we're lucky. Or creative enough with it.
And the fact that, like, that's also the Rick is, he's as brilliant and as smart as he is, he's also a cheater. Because, like, when he loses, he just doesn't admit defeat. He just goes and finds a reality where he somehow won. It's one of the pinnacles of Rick and Morty. It's got it all. It's got, like, some really funny stuff. It's got some really absurd stuff. Like, the whole idea, that the one of the premises of this episode and the reason it works is because the show's having a flu season dance, or the school's having a flu season dance. Not,
which is so dumb.
Not to spread the flu, but to raise awareness of the flu season. But they're doing this massive, where people are going to be dancing shoulder to shoulder, cheek to cheek.
It seems on the face of it a bad idea.
Yeah, it totally does. And also, one of the brilliant conceits is, and one of the reasons that Rick and Morty is so much fun to watch, is you keep getting more out of it. Like, this time, like, it came full circle to the fact that, like, Rick made this serum, but he also realized that if it combined with the flu, somewhere in the back of his mind, that would be bad, because he has that kind of realization later. But he's giving Morty this wildly dangerous concoction in the middle of flu season. So it's like,
but he's oblivious. He doesn't know it's flu season,
like, or he doesn't care. It's just like,
doesn't care.
And it's like, I said in the recap, this is against his better judgment, but I don't even know what that means. Like, Morty whined once or twice. And he's like, fine, take this, get off my back. The way he does with, so, like, you know, handing the Meeseeks box to his family could have gone terribly wrong.
Does a being with as much capability and as many outs as Rick even have a real grasp on the idea of consequences?
Yeah, and what would those consequences be? Because if he dies, presumably he just thinks he goes to nothingness. And if he can, if other than death, he can always just hop to another, you know, other than loss of his own perceived consciousness, he can recover from anything just by dimensional hopping.
And he's so selfish that he doesn't consider the consequences to the people around him.
Right.
Having lost their grandfather, the beloved grandfather, right? It would devastate Morty. It would crush Beth.
Yeah. And that's also, this is like something that you keep wondering about when you're pondering about like what, you know, the emotional stakes for Rick. It's like nothing can really threaten him. But you can threaten his family. But what does that mean? Because is there something is there something special in his relationship with Morty that he saves him? Is it only because Morty happened to be with him at the time? Is like a close approximation of his Beth good enough for him? Does he have such a poor relationship with his daughter and son-in-law that he wouldn't be able to tell if there's minute differences in their histories?
That's a question I hadn't considered.
Yeah.
Certainly seems like he doesn't give it much thought either.
Right, like it bothered, like I think it would, if he had a more rich relationship with this family, it would probably bother him more. And maybe that's one of the reasons he keeps him arm's length, because like, hey, you know, grandpa might have to bug out and leave everything behind, so I'm just, but that goes against the thesis of, which I guess I'm operating from, is Rick does at a core level care about his family. They are special in some way. Even if it's just
the fact that he's living with them still, I think says enough.
Yeah, maybe it's special in the same way that like your prized possessions are special. Like, you know, they're yours and they're familiar with to you, and you've had them, and it's no real, like, you're not, you know, you don't respect your razor like in any kind of real human way, but you don't want anyone else fucking with it. You don't want anybody else taking it and using it. It's yours. So it's, there's a lot of great philosophical and moral questions opened by this episode.
And they all come crashing down onto Morty, which I love.
Yeah, just his like just shell-shocked face with that song in the background is so great.
Let me ask you a question. I was reading through the wiki for this episode.
Uh-huh.
And it said, it starts this article with being too lazy to change things back to normal. Rick, you know, dimension hops here, abandons the dimension. I disagree with that. I don't think he's lazy. I think he's at the end of his rope. What's your read on the subject?
I think that Rick probably could have fixed it. I mean, obviously a different dimension of Rick did, you know, they're close enough dimensions that they all got Cronenberged, but one of them was able to fix it, you know, at the last minute. So it implies that like if Rick had worked harder, or maybe he was less sloppy. But no, I mean, because that's the other thing I kept on thinking is the town is like all fucked up and there's a bunch of stuff being destroyed and it's like partially on fire, but he's still trying to reverse it. It's like, you know, what does reverse mean when a whole world's been Cronenberg, several people have been murdered because you see, you know, like, Jerry has gone on a murder spree of Cronenberg creatures. Like, what would that, like, at what point does, like, even a fixed Earth still, it's so fucked up that it's personally inconvenient for Rick to stay around. So, like, is that laziness? Is that carelessness? Is that just, like, so it's like, you know, I'm trying to think of an example, like in a human example, like, you know, it's like the difference between like cleaning the house, like can your house get so dirty that it's better to just bulldoze it and start over? And, you know, is that mean you're lazy if you do that? And I guess maybe it's depending on like how big your pocketbook is. Like if Bill Gates' house got so messy, he just wanted to hire someone to come bulldoze it, start all over. He comes in a clean house. He could probably do that. And is Rick like Bill Gates in that situation?
Yeah, I don't know. My read on it is he says that this Rick in what I'm going to call the replacement dimension, because I think that's the colloquialism for it, is it got lucky. You know, he says he got lucky and the disaster was averted. He's also tried multiple times to fix this already, and he's failed spectacularly. He seemed pretty sure of that last attempt, and it didn't work out for him. So to me, Rick is really at the end of his rope. He's tried everything he can think of, and his emergency idea, as he calls it, is to just hop dimensions. Like, yeah. He's got this in his back pocket for when he actually can't figure his way out of a situation.
Right. But what's the threshold for when he pulls that lever? And, like,
I think the threshold is if he can't put it back to something that is recognizable for him and Morty, then he'll hop out. He'll pull the ripcord and get out of there.
Yeah, because that's the question. It's like, let's say the Rick couldn't hop dimensions. Mm-hmm. Was the world too fucked up for him to fix it? That's the question, and that's where the line between laziness and just like, you know, being your back against the wall is an interesting question, because it's like trying to say, you know, is the fire in this building out of control? Knowing that I can just walk out the front door and watch and then walk away from burning versus I'm trapped in this building. Like, the definition of fire out of control and you stop fighting, it's different in those circumstances. So,
and as we, you know, talked about Rick's selfishness fundamentally, I think he doesn't care so much about, like, oh, there were buildings that were burned down. There were a bunch of Cronenbergs who now would be turned back into regular people if I could fix this, who are dead and their families are going to be affected. And he doesn't care about that. It's really about, like, his microcosm of this world.
Or, like, I don't think he cares about it, too. But let's say that caused, like, $2 trillion in damages and the United States becomes bankrupt and becomes, like, a third world country. Like, I still think he thinks that's too ruined because it would impact his standard of living.
Yes, and I agree with
that. It would pinch his family and, like, you know, like, if another country gets, like, nuked, like a Madagascar gets nuked, like, I don't think he cares about that. But, like, where, you know, his own backyard getting materially degraded to where he can't have fun or he can't live comfortably anymore, I think would be enough for him to bail on the world.
Yeah, pretty fucked up.
Because it's certainly not, like, what happens to his family or his neighbors or even his fellow countrymen. It's definitely, like, what is the perceived experience to Rick? So
there are three dimensions that we get to see in this one.
Oh, yeah.
There's C-137, which is the sort of originating dimension.
That's the OG Rick.
Yeah, and that one gets Cronenberged.
Yep.
And along the lines of Cronenberg, we see in the stinger at the end, there are some Cronenberg Rick and Mortys who come through from wherever their dimension is, where Rick fucked it up and turned everybody into normal humans.
Right.
So they had to abandon it. It was too far gone. And they came to Rick's really fucked up C-137.
Yeah.
So we know that there is a Cronenberg world.
Okay. I guess you said scene. I was like, okay, but, like, that's definitely alluded to, or they stepped through it.
Right, right. That's where they came from. And then there's the replacement dimension where Rick and Morty end up at the end of this episode.
There's a lot of interesting things. Like, we talk about the big heady philosophies of, like, alternate dimensions and whatnot, but there's also, like, a thing about, like, in all this, there's also some interesting philosophizing about love. For example, you know, Rick's opinion is, like, love's just a chemical reaction that compels animals to breed, and he recommends that you break the cycle, rise above, focus on science. And then literally the next scene is Jerry asking Beth if she still loves him. And she gives, like, more of a practical answer, like, I really liked it. Like, do you want people to be homeless? Like, no. Do you want to build a homeless shelter? And she's like, yeah. So, like, everybody wants to say they love the homeless, but nobody wants to put in the work. And she's like, do you see me putting in work here? Does this seem
that's
like...
That's what means something.
Yeah. Does this seem like it's a lot of people aren't willing to put in the work. Loving you is hard work. Do you see me doing it? That's interesting. And it's like
Jerry just wants the yes or no, right? He just wants the answer that would assuage his fears.
Yeah. Or, like, and Beth gives him an answer, and instead of that being satisfying, it sends him, like, or it's another one's like, maybe it's a wake up call. It's like, oh, well, maybe I could see what it would look like to make myself less of a person that's hard work to love. You know, I don't know. It's interesting because there's a very similar scene in, like, Fiddler on the Roof where, like, you know, that's all about communities that are engage in, you know, arranged marriages, and they're very young. And it's the main character, a mother and father, like, talking about whether they love each other. And it's like, you know, what does that even mean? For 20 years, I've been doing your laundry and cooking your food and doing all this stuff. And then, but it's this duet. And at the end of it, they realize that despite everything, they have built a nice life and they do love each other. This is like the flip side of this, where it's like, yeah, I'm putting on the work, but, and it's been a long time, and we've got a teenage daughter and teenage son, but, like, I think I hate your guts. That's like the way that duet would go.
Yeah.
It's definitely not a realization that, like, yeah, we've been going through the motions, and, oh, we found it in love. We've been going through the motions and found that we're completely different people that don't have anything in common together. And it's sad.
I find it interesting that over the course of this episode, I understand what they're going for. They're trying this, you know, zombie apocalypse style survivor group at the end with the C-137 family. But Jerry saves Beth because his own insecurity has driven him to where he has to know if she's cheating on him. Mm-hmm. And he will not let anything stand in his way until he finds that information out, right? Mm-hmm. I'm surprised that Beth's character as someone who would understand Jerry is in a weird place here. Like, why is Jerry here in the office right now? Mm. Why is he crashing through the door at this moment? And sort of question that, but she doesn't in this episode. And so I think they're going for something else, and so they sort of ignore that a little bit. I don't want to call it, like, you know, bad writing. I don't think it's bad writing. It's just something that a choice they made.
Well, I think that this is why it must be so heady to work on the show. It's because, like, a lot of that concern is answered by the fact that Beth just literally saw her coworker explode into a praying mantis monster.
But that's a distraction, right? From the smarter character that we know Beth is.
Yeah.
The more aware character.
But, like, when Jerry, like, the other thing is, like, I think that, you know, Jerry's finally there for her in a moment, like, maybe he's not been in a long time, or maybe he's never been, and assertive and kicking ass and just saved her life, and, like, you know, almost like a fantasy version of what Jerry could be, and she's not going to ask too many questions. She just instantly falls into this, like, Sarah Connor role, and they're going to kick ass across the wasteland. What is it about this that makes Jerry cool? Like, is it just
Oh, it's the one-liners, for one.
Well, but I mean, like, but what unlocks this about him? Did he, like, literally, he finally had nothing left to lose? He had no self-respect. He had, because he thought he was going to go to, confront this his wife, who's having sex with the younger, better-looking, more intelligent, successful man. Mm-hmm. And was it that, plus the stress of the praying mantis people trying to kill him? Like, I don't know. Like, what? I almost wonder if, like, this is a realistic portrayal of Jerry in this situation.
Okay. Well, I think it evolves over the course of the episode.
Yeah.
I think at first, yeah, it's insecurity, it's jealousy, it's all of those things. But then it becomes something different.
Hmm.
At the point where he sees that his actions have actually won Beth over, and that's the hard work he needed to put in.
Yeah.
He understands that, which is uncharacteristically Jerry.
Yes.
So he has a moment of clarity, and he sort of uses that to become this person that he has to be. Or it could just be that Jerry, when the chips are down and there is truly some danger, springs into action and becomes an entirely different person.
Well, and you also wonder, so that's, you know, goes back to the conversation we're having in the last few episodes, is, like, you know, on the patheticness of Jerry.
Yeah.
Is Jerry pathetic because he, from a very early age, was beaten down, experienced loss after loss after loss, and made him more and more insecure, and then here's a situation where he kind of makes a snap decision to grab the shotgun and start shooting, which led to success, success, success. Like, is he literally, being bullied by his dad, or maybe kids at school, away from being this awesome version of Jerry he could have always been?
Could be.
One other thing I wanted to say that I noticed kind of for the first time, In the replacement dimension, we see Rick just landing a saucer in the driveway, while it's like this their street's having an idyllic, you know, there's kids playing ball in the front, and there's newspapers being delivered, neighbors waving hi. All this is going on, he just lands this flying saucer in the middle of the driveway, and no one pays it any mind.
I mean, it's like the scene in Back to the Future where they take off down the middle of the street.
I guess that's,
into the sky.
I guess that's true, but they don't make it a point of, like, everyone out there watching them. You know, it's like, is there just enough weird shit going on at the Smith residence that no one really pays it any mind anymore? Is it, is Rick got some kind of, like, oblivion field that, like, keeps people from noticing the weird shit that's going on in his life? That's, I thought, was kind of interesting. And I don't know. You're right. It might just be an homage to Back to the Future, where it's like, well, Doc didn't give a fuck about where he's going. And and revealing his power level, so why would Rick?
If you don't have the flu, then don't bother listening. The flu's not as glistening all around us. I'm a flu-hating rapper.
We're getting geared up for the 6th annual Summer Badass Fest. And while we're working on a slate of Apex badass films to enjoy, we've got an early action-packed announcement to make.
Just like last year, we're kicking off Badass Season with a live movie watch and podcast recording. We've rented out a theater for connoisseurs of action films and Bald Move fans that just want to have a great time.
Unlike last year, this year's movie is top secret. Hush, hush. No hints. Except, it's incredibly badass. It stars an absolute icon of the genre. We're willing to bet most of you haven't seen it, and it's going to be an incredible viewing experience with a packed house of Bald Movers.
Those of you who came to last year's screening of Total Recall know what a party it was. And those of you who didn't, now's your chance to experience it. Meet me and Jim. Order some custom movie-themed drinks at the theater's full bar. Then watch us record the full podcast for the movie. We reserved a venue over twice the size as last year, but seating is still limited.
It's happening Friday, June 21st at 7 p.m. in our hometown of Cincinnati. Get full details and buy tickets at baldmove.com/live.
Cincinnati's actually a pretty great city to visit, and we've got lots of details for side adventures on our event page as well. The Reds are playing the Boston Red Sox in their fantastic Riverside Stadium. The thrills of Kings Island just minutes away, and I'll be leading a kayak trip down the scenic Little Miami River on Saturday.
Again, get full details and get your tickets now on our Badass Fest 6 page at baldmove.com/live.
Here are the highlights coming up this week on Bald Move.
House of the Dragon Season 2 is coming up sooner than you think. And to get us all back in that Leal state of mind, Aaron and I have teamed up with Maester Anthony to bring you coordinated coverage, new and old. For the next 10 weeks leading up to Season 2, Maester Anthony will be releasing an episode of his Season 1 coverage on the Hot D podcast. He originally recorded and released it exclusively on his Double Dragon podcast, so while it's retro coverage, it's almost certainly new to you.
In addition, each Friday, Jim and I will be reading the relevant sections of George Martin's Targaryen history book, Fire and Blood, so that we can compare and contrast it to that week's episode of Hot D Season 1. So grab a copy of Fire and Blood and read along with us if you're so inclined. Just don't read ahead, unless you enjoy spoilers.
If that's not enough to satisfy your craving for fantasy entertainment, well, you're in luck. We recently watched King Arthur, Legend of the Sword, which is Guy Ritchie's uniquely stylish and anachronistic riff on the King Arthur legend. Yes, Guy Ritchie took on the most famous of all English legends and did it with huge ambitions. Sadly, or perhaps thankfully, depending on your tastes, his ambitions were cut short by meager audience interest. Join us for the podcast this Tuesday as we discuss why that might have been and whether this retelling is any good.
You can find these and many other great podcasts by searching for Bald Move Pulp or Bald Move Prestige in your favorite podcast app. All right, Jim, now it's time for a segment we like to call Plot to the Future, where we open up the portal to Dimension BM77 and use that awesome, terrible power to glimpse behind-the-scenes details, trivia, and spoilers for future episodes. So, that sounds like a bad time if you're a first-time Rick and Morty person. You want to preserve the mystique and the mystery. Bail now. One thing that struck me when I was listening to the commentary is like it felt like that the crew is really conscious of how mind-blowing this episode would be, and they consciously put it in this particular point in the season as kind of like, you know, you felt like you had an idea of what Rick and Morty's going to be about, and then we're going to like hit you with the kind of far off simulation episode, and then we're going to kind of do a fun one with Meeseeks, and then bam, just when you get you feel like you got your feet footing, here comes a Cronenberg disaster. I don't know, I just really I really enjoy the fact that they take time, even in from, like, you know, the idea of, like, when the episodes come out. Like, they really take the time to think about how that's going to be impacting the audience and trying to use even the placement of stuff in the season. And also reminds me of, like, you know, like, some of the more the less fortunate franchises like Firefly and how, you know, Fox, when they were airing that, didn't give a fuck about what order they're aired in and how that can really, like, that must really, like, feel like your heart's being torn out when you try to do your best. And then, you know, I was just thinking, like, how pissed off everybody. Yeah, they take the order of episodes and just, and this is, like, the finale. And
or if this was episode two, like they originally thought, it would not work.
Yeah, because you didn't.
I think it could ruin the show.
Because you don't care enough about the episode. You don't care enough about the characters to understand what a violation it is. But also, like, if this happened, like, in middle of season two, it might be the other way. Like, the characters are so attached that you're just like, I can't forgive Rick from doing this. It's like, I want to say it's the perfect time, and I know it's probably could have done
good,
it
though.
It's great placement, plus or minus one or two episodes of being the perfect placement. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, it's still able to set a tone for Rick and Morty as a series at episode six. Whereas episode two, yeah, I think it would have been too soon. You do it too late. It's already like, okay, well, this is not particularly new for Rick and Morty, but yeah, great placement.
Yeah, I thought it was also insightful that I think this is Harmon talking about that the way they arrived at this version of Jerry is that what level of dysfunction does the universe need to display for Jerry to be functional?
Okay.
And it turns out full Cronenberg dysfunction is where Jerry can kind of relax and be himself, which is still pretty fucking pathetic.
Yeah, more so.
Yeah. Like, you have to have an artificially engineered situation for you to be, like, a hero to your wife and child. It is kind of dark, though, from the Stinger's perspective of even living in this hellish existence, they are more satisfied because Rick is out. They say Rick and Morty, but I think it's really Rick. Rick being out of their life, like, Rick is such a cause of their misery. And you can see, like, Summer, they have... you know, they haven't really sketched Summer really in a detailed way, but they made it a point to have her be the one character that's kind of defiant to Grandpa here, calls him out for his gross asshole behavior. Because through this, like, Rick's trying to play everyone against each other. He's like saying, you know, like, love is shit, and like your relation, like, you know, there's ways you can support a person's relationship and ways you can, like, you know, pull the Jenga sticks out from under it, and Rick's definitely doing the latter.
Oh, absolutely. The thing that struck me, though, about Rick saying, you know, the this virus of love got your father, it got me, don't, like, break the cycle, just focus on science, implies that Rick at some point did love something.
Yeah.
And maybe still does. Maybe still does, therefore. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, a little wrinkle. A little wrinkle in Rick.
A little wrinkle? A wrinkle in time?
The
other thing is, like, and I knew this just from being a Harmontown fan, but the flu-hating rapper that's kind of like doing background vocals, that's Dan Harmon.
Yeah.
Doing patented Dan Harmon rapping. which, to be fair, he continues to learn and grow as an artist.
He's a rapper and a writer?
Yes. It turns out you keep doing anything over an extended period of time and you'll get marginally better at it. I think he writes a lot more than he raps. But throughout the run of Harmontown, there's like going on 300 episodes, more than 300 episodes. Like, there's been some genuine fire verses every once in a while. Okay. It comes together
all off the cuff.
Sometimes, like, I remember one episode in particular. He had another rapper, Open Mike Eagle, on, and they're trying to get it because, like, Dan runs home to mama in the form of fucking your mama raps.
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's fucking your mama, this and that, fucking from north to south. And, like, I felt like a lot of that exercise was kind of getting him away from the mama fucking. But that's fun, too.
There's a second commentary on this.
The one with
Blu-ray.
The Simpsons cast.
Yeah,
or creators.
Yeah. Matt Groening and a whole bunch of other people.
Yeah.
From The Simpsons. which I didn't find particularly entertaining. I didn't care for it.
They tend to have like a they like Rick and Morty, and they are kind of envious of some of the things it does. And but I guess I was really excited, like, oh shit, the creators of The Simpsons, like, what will they say about this? And there's obviously a lot, because I knew that they, you know, they let Rick and Morty do this very extended couch gag, like a 5-minute version of the opening couch gag. Yeah. So I knew there was like a lot of like love and affection between those two series. Yeah. What do you think is, what's the,
I mean, the highlight for me was when they were talking about, or I guess the thing that stuck with me the most is when they're talking about Fox having passed on this show, like they sort of pitched a version of Rick and Morty, which wasn't quite Rick and Morty, to Fox, and Fox turned it down. And, you know, they're obviously famous for The Simpsons, Futurama, all those, like, you know, the beloved cartoon, the beloved animations. I don't think that was a mistake on Fox's part. I don't think you could make this show on Fox. I don't think Fox would have let this show become Rick and Morty.
Although they did do like Family Guy.
Yeah, but the Family Guy's not that subversive.
It's not that.
This episode has a scene that turns from a rape scene to a pedophilia scene. Like,
right,
Fox
right.
ain't gonna let that fly.
Yeah, I mean, you're right that there would be that a lot of the edges would be sanded down, and I think it would have not been as great as. But I'm like, just it being the edgy humor, I feel like Family Guy is. I mean, they probably wouldn't have gotten away as bleeping as many cuss words. But sure. I don't know. Some of the big science fiction subversion, you're right. It would have filing down the edges of the show would make it not be Rick and Morty anymore.
Yeah, I think so.
Being in the environment of like a broadcast television show versus Adult Swim, which, you know, Adult Swim, you know, they traffic in high concept, you know, sometimes juvenile, sometimes smart, you know, kind of gross out humor and stuff like that. I wonder if even that just changes how like they wouldn't even have thought to do some of the things they've done on Rick and Morty, just because like it just never, it, being in that box, it's not as freeing, so the thought processes don't happen. And,
or they would have shut it down before the ideation phase even got to the point where they came up with something
good.
We'll
never get past standards and practices. Right. So, like, where this show, we actually write something we think will be rejected from standards of practice, which is our way of reminding ourselves to change it, and oh shit, just got approved.
Right.
Yeah. One other thing I want to talk about, this is kind of like spoilers for the future, and some people like, you know, like to track this kind of thing, but like Rick, so he is from the dimension known as C-137. They go to this other dimension, which is just called the replacement dimension. There is something, and one thing I had a question, and I did a little bit of research, is like, does Rick, you know, because like later on when he's dealing with the Council of Ricks and other things, like, does he identify as the dimension that he's originally from? Is he trying to pass himself off as the dimension from the replacement? And there's a couple indications of this. Like, one of them is during episode two, Morty Night Run. That's the one where he checks Jerry into like a Jerry daycare, a Jerry romper room. Mm-hmm. And he puts down his own, like, you know, dimension he's from as C-137. He puts Jerry's dimension as N-A. And I wonder, what are they trying to say there? Are they trying to, for whatever reason, avoid committing to actually naming this dimension just to give him some freedom or in the future? Are they saying that Rick literally doesn't give a fuck? Because in that episode, also at the end, when
that he's so one dimensional that he doesn't even have a dimension. Like, is this Rick taking a jab at Jerry?
Yeah, or it could be all of the above. Like, you know, it's like it matters so, like, Jerry's existence matters so little to Rick that he would accept literally anything that looks like Jerry back.
Right.
And then it's like at the end, like, there's almost a mix up where, like, they get the wrong Jerry and then they hand them off, but like, are we sure they got the right Jerry back? And would it matter? I mean, there's a lot of interesting questions just there. But it does feel like when you look at some of these Wikipedias and like all the detailed history and like all the different dimensions that they've cataloged, it is kind of bizarre that we don't have a handle on this replacement dimension that vast majority of the Rick and Morty action is going to take place in.
Yeah.
Although one ultimate answer to whether Rick's lazy or not is if in like season 5 he comes back and fixes the Cronenberg dimension.
Okay.
Like he finally is like, you know, he rolls up his sleeves, like, I'm gonna do it. And
it could be with the evolving character of Rick that you know, he does deep down have some kind of attachment to it, right? And he does want to come back and try and fix it.
I mean,
because
we've seen that original family now, and they're like
they're pretty far gone.
They're different.
Yeah.
But Rick, I mean, he can roll with that. Rick rolls with post-apocalyptic civilizations all the time, semi-regular basis, so.
Pickle Me This is distributed by Bald Move in association with Starburns Audio. It's produced by Jason Smith and Scott Porch from Starburns, and myself, Ben Aaron from Bald Move. All music featured on this podcast is from the Rick and Morty soundtrack, available from Sub Pop Records. Please subscribe, rate, and review us on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts. To discover the many other great shows we do, please check out baldmove.com and starburns.audio. If you appreciate what we do and want to directly support us, consider joining our club at club.baldmove.com to get access to exclusive bonus audio and video features. Finally, you can follow us on your favorite social media, @baldmove. See you next time.